getting a little bit away from the theme of how FDR was treated in these pieces, I found it fascinating your discussions of how these dramas dealt with the British and with the Soviets and the different obstacles that they had to confront in creating warmer feelings for these disparate peoples. And the British, I understand, there were certain prejudices that Americans had about the British that these playwrights and actors had to overcome. Could you talk a little bit about that and also on the obstacles, the obvious obstacles that they had to overcome in American attitudes toward the Soviets?
Well, yes. As far as the British were concerned, remember that the British were doing quite a bit of propaganda during World War I before the U.S. came in to try to bring the U.S. into the war. That was resented by a number of Americans at the time, and it was remembered after the war concluded. When Britain became involved in World War II in September of 39, right after the German attack on Poland, of course, the question quickly arose in the U.S., were we going to come to Britain's aid? And that's a point at which a lot of the people who were Anglophobes were, you know, very inclined to speak out and rip into the British. There were some broadcasts done before Pearl Harbor to try to deal with that type of criticism. And then, of course, after Pearl Harbor, now we were allied with the British officially, and there were continued efforts to the point that Corwin, who had done that 7 or 8 part series in the early part of 42, was asked to do another series over in Britain to be beamed to the U.S. And this series was called An American in England, or American in Britain, I forget which. And he brought over one of the writers, one of the actors whom he particularly liked, a man named Joseph Julian, to be the narrator of the series. And then there were some transmission problems from Britain, so eventually Corwin wound up coming back to the U.S. and repeating a few broadcasts and perhaps even writing another one or two to add to this series, but that were, you know, produced within the U.S. And, you know, the effort was to show that the British were a courageous people, that they were our cultural brothers, and that they therefore deserved our support and our respect. And I have to say, some of these shows went to great lengths to do that. This was not a show by Corwin, but there was a show that was done, I'm pretty sure before Pearl Harbor, that portrayed a village that had been bombed by the Germans, an English village. A young woman from the village escapes unharmed, but totally traumatized, comes to a high hill above the village, and there she meets a pilot who has just crash-landed, and his hands are bleeding, and they have a conversation, and he tries to encourage her to look on the bright side. She survived, and so on and so forth. And to make a long story short, at the end of the broadcast, at the end of the script, she turns away for a while, and looks back, and he has disappeared. But there are two spikes left there. And remember, I said his hands were bleeding. And I don't have the exact wording in front of me, but clearly there was an analogy being made there that perhaps this pilot was in fact Jesus Christ. And, you know, I mean, talk about God on your side.
Absolutely. How about the Stalin and the Soviets?
Okay, the Soviet Union, of course. There was plenty of hostility toward the Soviet Union and within the U.S. And after the war began, there was a concentrated effort in various ways, both on commercial radio and also particularly in some government broadcasts, to show the Soviets as what they were, our allies, that they were fighting valiantly, which they were, that they you know, men and women and sometimes children were enlisted in the effort to fight the good cause. And they generally didn't deal too much with the, you know, the more controversial aspects of the Soviet Union. Some of them went a little bit over the top in trying to portray Stalin as a kind of a democratic and very tolerant leader. And I comment in the book about that. In one case, there was a broadcast in the very popular March of Time sort of dramatized news series, which presented Stalin as being just open to criticism, which he was not. He simply was not. And then there was also a remarkable show in which a woman fighter pilot went up and went on a sortie, and it mentions that she was pregnant. It also mentions that she was in her ninth month.
Oh my!
And I have trouble envisioning a woman in her ninth month getting into the pilot's seat in a jet plane. But you know, this, as I said, this was going a little bit over the top. But it was felt that it was important to you know, not only try to unite the American population behind the war effort, but also to see that, you know, all the good people in the world, you know, were on the same side.
Now, many of the writers at the time also took the opportunity to attack racism and anti-Semitism. You've got a chapter, actually you have more than a chapter in the book. That's it's a central theme through the book, I think, is the opportunities that were open to producers, to writers, to use radio to fight intolerance. Could you talk a little bit about what happened during the war along these lines?
Yes. Early in the war, the African-American actor, Canada Lee, who, I remind you, was blind in one eye and basically was a bit old to be drafted, was talking to a group of students at the City College uptown in Manhattan. And here was a black man living in a racially segregated society, racially segregated not just in the South, but throughout much of the North. You know, the existence of Harlem was testimony to that, black people not being able to get housing in various parts of the city, many parts of the city. And he made a comment to the effect that something like he would have difficulty urging young black men, or to use the term of the time, young Negro men, to enlist in the service in a racially segregated armed forces. And what he said reflected the sentiments of many black people. They were being asked to fight for democracy. But what did democracy mean to them? Many, many, many black Americans could not vote in the 1940s and had no reason to know that a civil rights movement would take place a generation later. Virtually all black people were aware of the horror of lynchings which were going on around the country, and the fact that Congress took no action, passed no legislation to make lynching a federal crime. And so this was a big issue, and the government and radio realized that they needed to address the sentiments of people like Canada Lee. So they enlisted radio writers, for example, Langston Hughes, the Harlem Renaissance poet, was brought in to write some shows to try to convince black Americans that the war effort was their war effort, that if Hitler came or the Japanese came and took over in America, they would be much worse off, and that there was cause for hope in America, and they really had to come and support the war effort. And of course, you know, just hundreds of thousands of I don't know the numbers, but you know, black Americans did go into the service, even though it was racially segregated. In the Navy, they served as you know, messmen and things like that because they could not become regular sailors. In the Army, you know, there were black fighting units.
And many of these dramas celebrated the bravery of African Americans, not only during World War II, but I remember your discussion of one piece, The Battle of Henry Johnson, who's somewhat of a local hero here in Albany, New York. And I think that was produced by the U.S. Office of Education, part of Freedom's People, that series?
Yes, yes. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I actually wrote, I didn't get a response from him, but I wrote to Mr. Johnson's son after he received that posthumous award for his father. I think it was a Congressional Medal of Honor.
Yes.
If I remember correctly, The Battle of Henry Johnson was probably produced before Pearl Harbor, but this was the government gearing up.
I think it was a couple of weeks right after Pearl Harbor. I think the end of December of 1941. Yeah.
Right. They were, and this was about a battle during World War I, but, you know, it was implying that, you know, or stating that black Americans are patriotic Americans, and, you know, we need to all pull together, because that's the second theme, that in addition to these shows being broadcast with the intention of trying to create positive attitudes among black Americans, it was also trying to reduce racial tensions and to get the message across to white people, and particularly to bigoted white people, that black Americans are indeed doing their share. And so we need to pull together and drop all these antagonisms. And some of these antagonisms were rather frightening during World War II. In the summer of 1943, for example, there was tension in a number of American cities, particularly in Detroit, where racial riots broke out. And one of the best known and perhaps the best radio play dealing with black Americans during World War II was a Peabody Award-winning show by a man better known as a radio director, William Robeson. And that was, there's a couple of different interpretations of why he wound up writing that, but in any case, CBS took on the task, but they took it on with a lot of nervousness, because after all, they were going to try to portray black Americans in a very positive light in relation to this particular racial conflict that had broken out in Detroit. And they were worried that a number of their affiliates would have a problem with this, as a few did in the South and perhaps even in some other parts of the country. This Robeson showed that white racism basically was the driving force behind the riots. Generally, those kinds of shows could not be done on the networks for the reasons I just described. And so the best series, perhaps, during the war that dealt with blacks was a local series in New York City produced on station WMCA, which was then owned by Nathan Strauss, who was the father of Peter Strauss of Strauss Communications in Manhattan. He's currently in the communications business, the son of this Nathan Strauss. And the Strausses were quite liberal people. Nathan Strauss had been, head of FDR's housing administration before he came back to New York City, bought this radio station, and put on this series called New World A Coming. Canada Lee was the narrator. And I read some of the scripts from this show and discussed them in the book, In Words at War. And they're quite well done. There's one about that the famous Tuskegee Airmen, which was this black flying unit established during World War II, which compiled quite a record during the war. I'm trying to think, were they fighter pilots or were they bombers? But in any case, this series could not be done on a national basis.
You mentioned that you read through the scripts. Were these programs also available on recordings?
I think I actually have one or two shows from the series, but in this particular case, I think that the shows, that the quality of the sound is not that good.
How about in the other series that you researched? Are there good collections that perhaps the listening audience could find somewhere?
Well, yes. The Cavalcade of America series, which is kind of interesting to listen to it. I liked them in the beginning, and then I found them more recently to be a little not quite as good quality as I thought in the beginning. But it's an interesting series, and that's available, I think, from a company called Radio Spirits, which I think can be found on the Internet. And then there's a whole bunch of hobbyists around the country, some of whom have gone commercial. And if you look up old-time radio on the Internet, you can find some of these people who sell these shows, or some will trade them only, but they are available. A lot of them are sort of pirated copies, and there's a... some sloppiness in observing copyright protections, but that's another story.
Yeah.
But there are quite a number of shows available. I mean, this series I mentioned before that was written by Alan Sloan and Arthur Lawrence, the man behind the gun, there's a few shows of that circulating, and they're fun to listen to.
I'm sure. We'll try to get some copies of them and air them on our show in the near future,
all
too.
Right.
We don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to skip a lot of my questions, which I really wanted to ask you about women and labor and all of these wonderful themes. I should have you back for a second show, because you've got this so much wonderful information in the book and in
Thank
your
you.
Head that I hate to just spend one show on this, but let's move forward at this point. What happened to these writers, the people who participated in the program?
Well,
what happened to the writers and the actors?
Okay, well, they I think they, as a group, loved their jobs. They had a chance to do good writing. They loved radio, a lot of them, not all of them. Norman Rostin and Arthur Miller were just disenchanted with radio because it was, you know, the broadcasts were too short, and something was broadcast once, unlike a stage play, which could have, you know, a longer run. Among those, particularly, this was hurtful among those who liked radio and wanted to keep their careers on radio. In the late 40s, through a combination of circumstances, for one thing, there was a more of a commercialization of radio, and so the highbrow shows were going to go out the window anyway, to a large extent, but also because of the blacklist that began to emerge. The Cold War had begun. We switched enemies. I once heard the Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal speak on Long Island. This goes back 15 or 20 years ago. And he talked about how he had been working for the U.S. Army in Germany after World War II, helping them. This is how he got his start as a Nazi hunter, helping to track down Nazi war criminals. And one day he came back to his office, and they were packing everything up and closing shop. And he said, "What's going on?" He said, "We've got a new enemy now. Germany's not our enemy, so we're not going to concentrate as much as we used to on finding the Nazi war criminals." The Korean War broke out. We had the Rosenberg trial, the testing of the first Soviet atomic bomb, and Americans became very scared of communism, and there were people like Joseph McCarthy and others who capitalized on that and struck out against anybody who looked like a potential, you know, leftist, fellow traveler, what have you. And I think I mentioned before this publication that came out in the late spring of 1950, Red Channels, by three former FBI agents. Within the acting profession, well, let me finish my point about that. It came to be found in the top drawer of many broadcasting executives' desks. CBS hired a vice president in charge of carrying out the blacklist. Now, the blacklist didn't initiate within CBS, but there were private individuals and groups that started contacting the networks and started putting pressures on the sponsors. And so we see the blacklist starting to develop. CBS hired a man by the name of Daniel O'Shea. Daniel O'Shea had a background in the film industry, I believe, and then eventually went back to it. But one of the writers called him the vice president of treason, or of going after traitors. And O'Shea would take information from these private individuals who alleged certain things about these network employees, writers, actors, and others. And then he would call people in, and he would question them. And if he didn't like the kinds of answers that he was getting, or if he didn't sense contrition, then he was instrumental in getting people canned from the network. And in some cases, people weren't canned because they weren't regularly employed by the network, but they just, you know, kept getting jobs with the network or with the ad agencies that produced shows that they sold to the networks. And people were not normally told why they couldn't be employed anymore, but they were just, you know, told, well, we can't use you for this particular show. And they came back again, and we can't use you for this one either, and so on. And then they start to see their incomes drying up. And people, and these people became very, very demoralized. A few caved in. And what the congressional committees that were complicit in this whole process wanted constantly was they had a tremendous appetite for names. And they often wanted people to name others as communists, even though they already had several people identifying that person. But they were trying to sew it as tightly as possible. Alan Sloan, whom I mentioned, was one of the people. He had been a member of the party, and he caved into the pressures and named a couple of people. And of course, you know, we see, you know, to this day, I've talked with a number of actors and writers who are still caught up with the tragedy of that era.
So I take it then most progressives and liberals were purged then from radio at the time.
They were purged from radio. Some of them were affected for decades. Now, I have not found very much about Burgess Meredith being purged, but I take him at his word, because it could be verified, that he was unable to get a film for over 10 years. He was one of the people. He was an announcer more than an actor on radio. He may have done some acting, too. Canada Lee was bounced off. In two cases, people who had done a lot of radio, or done some radio as actors, met very, very tragic ends. Canada Lee had hypertension and some other health problems, and all of this was tremendously exacerbated by the fact that he was losing his living. And he died prematurely in about May of 1952, the same month in which the film and sometime radio actor John Garfield also died of a heart ailment that was clearly also influenced by the tremendous tensions and pressures that he was under. So yes, they were purged, and it was a very, very sad time in American history. The Hollywood blacklist has been extensively documented, but the broadcasting industry blacklist, which is a significant part of the story of my book, Words at War, has not been. And I'm very happy that I've been able to do that and to, in some cases, correct the historic record. For example, Canada Lee, in the late 40s, was visited, as his widow told me, was visited by two FBI agents at his at their apartment in Harlem. And they didn't come because they wanted Canada Lee. They wanted because they want they came because they wanted him to denounce actor Paul Robeson. And Lee absolutely refused. But the word was spread, and then, you know, I have my strong guesses who spread this rumor, that Canada Lee had denounced Paul Robeson and accused him of being a communist. They had been somewhat friendly. I have never found a shred of evidence to verify this, and yet, curiously and ironically, that myth has been perpetuated so that I have two books on my shelves by, I think, two well-meaning writers who discuss, who focused on the blacklist in their two books. I have seen I've seen one website which discusses Canada Lee and also repeats the false statement that Lee denounced Robeson. His widow told me that it was not true. And in fact, Paul Robeson Jr. told me that he has never seen any evidence to verify that Lee made those allegations against his father. So it's a strange thing that in some ways the FBI succeeded in this one instance that I know of in rewriting history.
Well, I certainly want to thank you for the insight you've given us into the broadcasting blacklist. And indeed, that is a part of a very rich and wonderful book in general. We've been talking to Howard Blue, author of Words at War, World War II Era Radio Drama and the Post-War Broadcasting Industry Blacklist. It was published by Scarecrow Press last year. And for more information about the book, you can go on the web at www.scarecrowpress.com.
And if I may...
Absolutely. I was going to give you an opportunity for closing words.
I have a website, too. And the book is available both from Scarecrow Press, from me. It's in some of the bookstores from the chains, Borders, and Barnes & Noble. It's in Canio's Books in East Hampton, Long Island. It's in a number of bookstores around the country. My website is www.howardblue.com, and that's B-L-U-E, like the color.
Well, Howard, thank you very much for giving us an opportunity to talk to you about this wonderful topic.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.